Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for The Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. This episode features an hour with Michael Ondaatje from 2001. Michael Ondaatje first shot to fame in 1992 with the international bestseller The English Patient, which went on to become a film of the same name, winning, among other awards, the Academy Award for Best Picture. But these accomplishments hardly sum up a career of more than 50 years. Ondaatje's first book, A Collection of Poetry, was published in 1962, and since then, he has published dozens of books, including novels, poetry collections, plays, criticism, in addition to acting as an editor and an anthologist. What matters about Ondaatje is that, in many ways, he is the chronicler of the unobserved and quiet moments, of the characters who are not obvious heroes and who do not at first seem remarkable. His prose is rich and beautiful, as only a poet's can be, and the formal structure of his work defies conventional storytelling. This event was recorded in 2001, right around the publication of his novel, Anil's Ghost. To me, it is so exciting when an author of this caliber also becomes so popular. Here's Ondaatje.
This book, Anil's Ghost, the critics have said this is the most organized of my books, and I know that there's a very clear plot, etc., which startles me, so I'm going to confuse you by jumping back and forward, you know, as if it was an older book of mine. Anil is a woman who was born in Sri Lanka and has, since the age of about 18, worked in this went to school in England, to medical school, and then studied forensic studies in the States. And she returns to Sri Lanka as a part of a human rights project, and with a man named Sarath, who is an archaeologist, investigates the identity of a skeleton that has been found, which may lead to significant political changes. And along this, within this kind of very thin story, various things happen. They meet other people, a man named Palipana. They meet Sarath's brother, Garmini, who's a doctor, and others. I'm going to begin with a scene that begin, which is a prologue, which is, in fact, which takes place before she gets to Sri Lanka. When the team reached the site at 5:30 in the morning, one or two family members would be waiting for them, and they would be present all day while Anil and the others worked, never leaving. They spelled each other, so someone always stayed, as if to ensure that the evidence would not be lost again. This vigil for the dead, for these half-revealed forms. During the night, plastic sheeting covered the site, weighted down with stones or pieces of iron. The families knew the approximate hour the scientists would arrive. They removed the sheeting and got closer to the submerged bones until they heard the whine of the four-wheel drive in the distance. One morning, Anil found a naked footprint in the mud, another day a petal. They would boil up tea for the forensic team. In the worst hours of the Guatemalan heat, they held up a banana leaf to provide shade. There was always the fear, double-edged, that it was their son in the pit, or that it was not their son, which meant there would be further searching. If it became clear that the body was a stranger, then after weeks of waiting, the family would rise and leave. They would travel to other excavations in the Western Highlands. The possibility of their lost son was everywhere. One day, Anil and the rest of the team walked to a nearby river to cool off during their lunch break. On returning, they saw a woman sitting within the grave. She was on her haunches, her legs under her as if in formal prayer, elbows in her lap, looking down at the remains of the two bodies. She had lost a husband and a brother during an abduction in this region a year earlier. Now it seemed as if the men were asleep beside each other on a mat in the afternoon. She had once been the feminine string between them, the one who brought them together. They would return from the fields and enter the hut, eat the lunch she had made, and sleep for an hour. Each afternoon of the week, she was part of this. There are no words Anil knows that can describe, even for just herself, the woman's face. But the grief of love in that shoulder she will not forget, still remembers. The woman rose to her feet when she heard them approach and moved back, offering them room to work. She woke the next morning in her rented house in Colombo and walked into the darkness of the garden, following the sounds of coho birds busy with their claims and proclamations. She stood there drinking her tea, then walked to the main road as a light rain began. When a three-wheeler taxi stopped by her, she slipped into it. The taxi fled away, squeezing itself into every narrow possibility of the dense traffic. She held onto the straps tightly, the rain at her ankles from its open sides. The Bajaj was cooler than an air-conditioned car, and she liked the throaty, duck-like sound of the horns. Those first days in Colombo, it seemed she always found herself alone when the weather broke. The touch of rain on her shirt, the smell of dust in the wetness. Clouds would suddenly unlock, and the city would turn into an intimate village full of people acknowledging the rain and yelling to one another. Or there would be an uncertain acceptance of the rain in case it was only a brief shower. Years before, her parents had given a dinner party. They had set up the long table in their parched and dry garden. It was the end of May, but the drought had gone on, and still there was no monsoon. Then, towards the end of the meal, the rains began. Anil woke in her bedroom to the change in the air, ran to a window and looked out. The guests were scurrying under the thickness of the downpour, carrying antique chairs into the house. But her father and the woman he was beside continued to sit at the table, celebrating the break in seasons, as earth turned to mud around them. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, they sat and talked, she thought, just to make sure it was not a passing shower, to make sure the rain would keep coming down. Now rain swept across Colombo as her Bajaj proceeded via a shortcut towards the archaeological offices. Lights were coming on here and there in the small shops. She leaned forward. "Some cigarettes, please." They swerved to a halt against the pavement, and the driver yelled towards the shop. A man came into the rain with three different kinds of cigarettes, and she picked out the gold leaf package and paid him. They took off again. Suddenly, Anil was glad to be back, the buried senses from childhood alive in her. She entered the Kinsey Road Hospital and passed a sign by the chief medical officer's door. "Let conversations cease, let laughter flee. This is the place where death delights to help the living." It was printed in Latin, Sinhala, and English. Once in the laboratory where she worked now, she could relax, alone in the large room. God, she loved a lab. The stools always had a slight rake, so he sat in a lean. There would always be that earnest tilt forward. On the perimeter along the walls were the bottles that held beet-colored liquids. She could walk around the table, watching her body from the corner of her eye, then sit on the stool and time would be forgotten. No hunger or thirst or desire for a friend or lover's company. Just an awareness of someone in the distance hammering a floor, banging through ancient concrete with a mallet, as if to reach the truth. She stood against the table, and it nestled into her hip bones. She slid her fingers along the dark wood to feel for any grain of sand, any chip or crumb or stickiness in her solitude. Her arms, dark as the table, no jewelry except the bangle that would click as she lay her wrist down gently. No other sound as Anil thought through the silence in front of her. She knew herself to be and was known to others as a determined creature. Her name had not always been Anil. She had been given two entirely inappropriate names and very early on began to desire Anil, which was her brother's unused second name. She had tried to buy it from him when she was 12, offering to support him in all family arguments. He would not commit himself to the trade, though he knew she wanted the name more than anything else. Her campaign had caused anger and frustration within the household. She stopped responding when called by either of her given names, even at school. In the end, her parents relented, but then they had to persuade her irritable brother to forfeit his second name. He, at 14, claimed he might need it someday. Two names gave him more authority, and a second name suggested perhaps an alternative side to his nature. The parents threw their hands up, and finally the siblings worked out a trade between them. She gave her brother 100 save rupees, a pen set he had been eyeing for some time, a tin of cigarettes she had found, and a sexual favor he had demanded in the last hours of the impasse. After that, she allowed no other first names on her passports or school reports or application forms. Later, when she recalled her childhood, it was the hunger of not having that name and the joy of getting it that she remembered most. Everything about the name pleased her. Its slim, stripped-down quality, its feminine air, even though it was considered a male name. 20 years later, she felt the same about it. She'd hunted down the desired name like a specific lover she had seen and wanted, tempted by nothing else along the way. There were police officers all over the train. The man got on carrying a birdcage with a minor in it. He walked through carriages, glancing at other passengers. There were no seats left, and he sat on the floor. He was wearing a sarong, sandals, a Gore Road t-shirt. It was a slow train, traveling through rock passes, then emerging into sudden vistas. He knew that a mile or so before they got to Kurnagala, there would be a tunnel, and the train would curve into the dark claustrophobia of it. A few windows would remain open. They needed fresh air, though it meant the noise would be terrible. Once past the tunnel, back into sunlight, they would be getting ready to disembark. He stood just as the train went into darkness. For a few moments there was the faint, muddy light of the bulbs, and then they went out. He could hear the bird talking. 3 minutes of darkness. The man moved quickly to where he remembered the government official was, beside the aisle. In the darkness, he yanked him forward by his hair and wrapped the chain around his neck and began strangling him. He counted the seconds to himself in the darkness. When the man's weight fell against him, he still didn't trust him, didn't release his hold on the chain. He had a minute left. He stood and lifted the man into his arms. Keeping him upright, he steered him towards the open window. The yellow lights flickered on for a second. He might have been a tableau in someone's dream. He jerked the official off the ground and pushed him through the opening. The buffet of wind outside flung the head and shoulders backwards. He pushed him farther and then let go, and the man disappeared into the noise of the tunnel. In the ship's lab in the harbor one night, working alone, Anil cut herself badly with a surgical blade, slicing the flesh along her thumb. She poured Dettol over it and taped it, then decided to go to the hospital on the way home. There were about 15 souls sitting or lying on the long benches at emergency services. Now and then a doctor strolled in, signaled for the next patient, and went off with him. She was there for more than an hour and in the end gave up because more and more injured were coming in off the street and her wound began to seem insignificant in comparison. But that wasn't why she left. A man wearing a black coat walked in and sat down among them, blood on his clothes. He remained there in silence, waiting for someone to help him, not bothering to pick up a number like the rest of them. Eventually there were 3 empty spaces on the bench, and he stretched out, took off his black coat and used it as a pillow, but he couldn't sleep, and his open eyes stared across the room at her. His face was red and wet from the blood on the coat. He sat up, pulled a book out of his pocket and began reading very fast, turning pages, taking it in quickly. He swallowed a tablet and lay down again and this time dropped off, his circumstances and surroundings lost to him. A nurse approached him and touched him on the shoulder. When he didn't move, she kept her hand there. Anil was to remember all this very well. He got up then, pocketed the book, and touched one of the other patients and disappeared with him. He was a doctor. The nurse picked up the coat and took it away. That was when Anil left. If she couldn't tell who was who in a hospital, what chance did she have? That's actually one of the first sightings of Garmini, the doctor, and this is another sequence about him. In the operating rooms of the base hospitals in the North Central Province, there were always four medical techs in evidence. Doctors in the middle of an operation would have an orderly turn pages so they could skim the text while continuing surgery. After 2 weeks or 15-hour days, they no longer needed assistance from books and moved with ease alongside wounds and suture techniques, but the medical text remained for future doctors in training. In one of the books that the young Dr. Garmany read was a sentence he became excessively fond of. In diagnosing a vascular injury, a high index of suspicion is necessary. The hospital would run out of painkillers during the first week of any offensive, and you were without self in those times, lost among the screaming. You held onto any kind of odor, the smell of Savlon antiseptic that was used to wash floors, the children's injection room with its nursery murals. The older purpose of a hospital continued alongside the war. When Garmany finished surgery in the middle of the night, he walked through the compound into the east buildings where the sick children were. The mothers were always there, sitting on stools. They rested their upper torso and head on their child's bed and slept, holding the small hands. There were not too many fathers around then. He watched the children, who were unaware of their parents' arms. 50 yards away, in emergency, he had heard grown men scream for their mothers as they were dying. "Wait for me, I know you are here." This was when he stopped believing in man's rule on earth. He turned away from every person who stood up for a war, or the principle of one's land, or pride of ownership, or even personal rights. All of those motives ended up somehow in the arms of careless power. One was no worse and no better than the enemy. He believed only in the mothers sleeping against their children, the great sexuality of spirit in them, the sexuality of care, so the children would be confident and safe during the night. 10 beds skirted the edge of the room, and in the center was a nurse's desk. Garmany loved the order of those closed wards. If he had a few free hours, he avoided the doctor's dormitory and came here to lie on one of the empty beds, so that even if he could not sleep, he was surrounded by something he would find nowhere else in the country. He wanted a mother's arm to hold him firm on the bed, to lie across his ribcage, to bring a cool washcloth to his face. He would turn to watch a child with jaundice bathed in the pale blue light as if within a diorama, a blue light that was warm rather than clear, with a specific frequency. "Pass me a gentian, give me a torch." Garmany wished to be bathed in it. The nurse looked at her watch and walked from her desk to wake him, but he was not asleep. He drank a cup of tea with her and then left the pediatric ward, which had its own woes. Crossing the open grass lot, Garmany returned to the war rooms. There are several sequences in forest monasteries in Sri Lanka, and this is one passage where Anil goes with Sarath, the archaeologist. If it helps to know the order of the page numbers, this is 14, 66, 31, 38, 117. So you can see there's a, you know, there was a wonderful reading I heard by a writer in Canada, and she said, "I'm going to jump to another scene now, but don't worry, only 5 minutes has passed." I think about a couple of months have passed on. Once she and Sarath had entered the forest monastery in Arankale and spent a few hours there. A corrugated overhang was nailed into the rock of a cave entrance to keep out sun and rain. Beyond was a curved road of sand to a bathing pool. A monk swept his way along the path for 2 hours each morning and removed 1,000 leaves. By late afternoon, another 1,000 leaves and light twigs had fallen upon it. But at noon, its surface was as clear and yellow as a river. To walk this sand path was itself an act of meditation. The forest was so still that Anil heard no sounds until she thought of listening for them. Then she located the noisemakers in the landscape, as if using a sieve and water, catching the calls of orioles and parrots. Those who cannot love make places like this. One needs to be in a stage beyond passion. It was practically the only thing Saroth had said that day in Arankale. Most of the time he walked and slept in his own thoughts. They had wandered within the forest, discovering remnants of sights. A dog followed them, and she remembered Tibetans believed that monks who hadn't meditated properly became dogs in the next life. They circled back to the clearing. On a ledge of stone, a small statue of the Buddha rested. A cut plantain leaf protected him from glare and rain. The forest towering over them, so they felt they were within a deep green well. The corrugated overhang by the cave rattled and shook whenever the wind came down through the trees. There was no wish in her to step away from this place. Kings and those who are powerful desire what weighs them to the ground. Historical honor, measured ownership, their sure truths. But in Arankale, Saroth told her, in the last years of the 12th century, Asanga the Wise and his followers lived for decades in solitude, the world unaware of them. When they died, the monastery and then the forest were stilled of humans. And in those uninhabited years, the paths were leaf-filled. There was no song of sweeping. No odor of saffron or margosa came from the baths. Arankale perhaps became more beautiful, Arnel thought, and more subtle without humans in the structure they had designed when they were no longer in the currents of love. 4 centuries later, monks began living again in the caves above what had once been the temple clearing. It had been a long era of humanlessness, religiouslessness. The knowledge of such a monastery had vanished from people's minds, and the site was an abandoned forest sea. What was left of wooden altars was eaten by colonies of insects. Generations of pollen silted the bathing pool, and then rough vegetation consumed it, so it was invisible to any passerby who did not know its sudden loose depth, which was a haven for creatures. For 400 years, the unheard throat calls of birds, the hum of some medieval bee motoring itself into the air. And in the remnant of the 12th century well, under the reflected sky, a twist of something silver in the water. I'm going to read a section about Anil in America. And this is a scene in Arizona. I just picked Arizona because it was so dry. And she's working with another forensic specialist in the scene. It was in the Arizona labs that Anil met and worked with a woman named Leaf. A few years older, Leaf became Anil's closest friend and constant companion. They worked side by side and they talked continually on the phone to each other when one was on assignment elsewhere. Leaf introduced Anil to the finer arts of tenpin bowling, raucous hooting in bars, and high-speed driving in the desert, swerving back and forth in the night, avoiding the armadillos. Leaf loved movies and remained in depression about the disappearance of drive-ins and their alfresco quality. So 2 or 3 times a week, Anil would buy a barbecue chicken and arrive at Leaf's rented house. The television had already been carried out into the backyard and sat under a tree. They'd rent The Searchers or any other John Ford or Fred Zinnemann movie, sitting in Leaf's lawn chairs or curled up beside each other in the double hammock, watching the calm, carefully sexual, black-and-white walk of Montgomery Clift. Nights in Leaf's backyard, once upon a time in the West. The heat still in the air at midnight. They would pause the movie, take a break, and cool off under the garden hose. In 3 months, they managed to see the complete oeuvre of Andrew Dickinson and Warren Oates. "I'm asthmatic," Leaf said. "I need to become a cowboy." They shared a joint and disappeared into the intricacies of Red River, theorizing on the strangely casual shooting of John Ireland before the final fight between Montgomery Clift and John Wayne. They rewound the video and watched it once more, Wayne swirling around gracefully, hardly interrupting his walk to shoot a neutral friend who was trying to stop a fight. On their knees in the parched grass by the television screen, they looked at the scene frame by frame, for any sign of outrage at this unfairness on the victim's face, and there seemed to be none. It was a minor act, directed towards a minor character that may or may not have ended the man's life, and no one said anything about it during the remaining 5 minutes of the film. One of those Jacobean happy endings. I don't think the bullet killed him. Well, we can't tell where it hit him. Hawks goes off too quickly. The guy just puts his hand up to his stomach and then drops. Well, if he got hit in the liver, he's had it. Don't forget, this is Missouri in 18 knows when. Yeah. What's his name? Who? The guy shot. Valance. Cherry Valance. Cherry? You mean like Jerry or cherry like apple? Cherry Valance, not Apple Valance. And he's Montgomery's friend. Yeah, Montgomery's friend Cherry. I don't think it hit him in the liver. Look at the angle of the shot. The trajectory seems to be going up. Popped a rib, I suspect, or glanced off it. Maybe glanced off it and killed some moon on the sidewalk. Or Walter Brennan. No, some dame on the sidewalk that Howard Hawks was f***ing. Women remember, don't they know that? Those saloon girls are going to remember, Cherry. You know, Leif, we should do a book. A forensic doctor looks at the movies. Well, the film noir ones are tough. Their clothes are baggy, it's so dark. I'm doing Spartacus. In Sri Lankan movie theaters, Anil told Leif, if there was a great scene, usually a musical number or an extravagant fight, the crowd would yell out, replay, replay, or rewind, rewind, till the theater manager and projectionist were forced to comply. Now, on a smaller scale, the film staggered backwards and forwards in Leif's yard until the actions became clear to them. The film they worried about most was Point Blank. At the start of the movie, Lee Marvin, who once played Liberty Valance, no relation, is shot by a double-crossing friend in the abandoned Alcatraz prison. The friend leaves him for dead and steals his girl and his share of the money. Vengeance results. Anil and Leif composed a letter to the director of the film, asking if he remembered all these years later where on the torso he imagined Lee Marvin was shot, so that he could then get to his feet, stagger through the prison while the opening credits came up, and swim the treacherous waters between the island and San Francisco. They told the director that it was one of their favorite films. They were simply inquiring as forensic specialists. When they looked at the scene closely, they saw Lee Marvin's hand leap up to his chest. See, he has difficulty on his right side. When he swims later in the bay, he uses his left arm. God, it's a great movie. Garmany worked in the base hospital at Polonnaruwa during his last year in the Northeast. This was where the serious casualties from all over the eastern province were brought. The only cool place was the blood bank, where the plasma was refrigerated. The only silent place was rheumatology. In the corridors, the walls mildewed with dampness, men would be rolling giant cylinders of oxygen noisily off the carts. Oxygen was the essential river, hissed into neonatal wards where incubators sheltered babies. Outside this room of infants and beyond the shell of the hospital building was a garrison country. If there was a bombing or a village attack, they all became part of the hospital flying squad, and even those in the neonatal ward worked the triage and operating room. The specialists who came north seldom worked only in their own specific area of knowledge. They were in pediatrics one day, but might spend the rest of the week helping to contain an outbreak of cholera in the village settlements. If cholera drugs were not available, they did what doctors in another era had done: dissolved a teaspoon of potassium permanganate in a pint of water and poured it into every well or standing pool. The past was always useful. At one time, Garmany tried to keep an infant alive for 4 days. The girl could hold nothing down, not her mother's milk, not even water, and she was dehydrating. He remembered something and got hold of a pomegranate and fed the child the juice. It stayed down. Something he'd heard about pomegranates in a song his ayah had sung. It was legendary that every Tamil home in Jaffna Peninsula had 3 trees in the garden: a mango, a moringa, and the pomegranate. Moringa leaves were cooked in crab curries to neutralize poisons. Pomegranate leaves were soaked in water for the care of eyes, and the fruit eaten to aid digestion. And the mango was for pleasure. Gamini was working with Janica Fonseca in children's surgery when they began hearing news in the corridors that a village had been attacked. In front of him on the operating table was a small boy, naked except for white shorts, a huge mask over his tiny face. The two doctors had been preparing for the operation all week. Neither of them had attempted it before. They had been reading the text of the procedure in Kirkland's cardiac surgery over and over. They had to cool the boy's body down to 25 degrees Celsius by running cold blood into him, reducing his temperature until the heart stopped, and then they would operate. But as they began cutting, the wounded started coming into the halls, and they were aware of the flying squad in action around him. He and Fonseca stayed with the boy, keeping just one nurse, a heart the size of a guava. They opened the right atrium. This was as close to magic as the two of them got in their days there. They talked frantically back and forth to be certain of what they were doing. They could hear the carts carrying equipment or bodies, they couldn't tell which, racing down the halls. There had been a massacre, they now heard. A village 30 miles away had been pretty well wiped out. The child in front of them had a congenital abnormality, a beautiful kid. Gamini kept wanting to take the mask off and see his face again, wanted to look at the boy's dark black eyes, which had been full of trust, which had looked up at him as he gave the needle that had put him into uncontrolled sleep. Fallot's tetralogy, four things wrong with the heart. So he would live perhaps only into his early teens if they didn't operate now. A beautiful boy. Gamini was not going to leave him alone, betray him in his sleep. The operation took 6 hours, and all that time he stayed with the boy. He'd let Fonseca go after 3 hours. The nurse would have to help him reverse the bypass. He knew her as a starting intern, the Tamil wife of one of the staff. She and her husband had come to the peripheral hospital in the last month. Now Gamini stood by the boy and explained what they had to do. He would have to be rewarmed with blood at a higher temperature, and at the key moment, the bypass had to be removed. No one had ever performed that procedure in this country. So, in the fifth hour, Gamini and the nurse reversed the process that he and Fonseca had set up, the nurse watching him for any sign that what she was doing might be wrong. But she was faultless, faultless. Calmer, it seemed, than he was. This one, yes. I needed to cut a shallow 3-inch line there. No, to the left. She cut into the boy's body. Don't remain a nurse. You'll be a good doctor. She was smiling under the mask. As soon as the boy was in recovery, Gamini left him with her. There was no one else he could trust. He got two beepers and told her to contact him if something seemed wrong. He washed up and then went into the chaos of the triage. There was blood on everyone except him. It took a few more hours to deal with the crisis. In surgery, they wore white rubber boots, and all the doors had to be closed. Sometimes if a doctor had heat exhaustion, he slipped into the refrigerated blood bank for a few minutes among the plasma and packed cells. Gamini took over in surgery. All the survivors had been brought in by now. The killings had happened at 2 a.m. in a small village beside the main road to Batticaloa. They brought him 9-month-old twins, each shot in the palms, and one bullet each in their right legs, so it was no accident. A close-range job, and intentional, left to die. Yet, in a couple of weeks, those two children were peaceful things, full of light. You thought, what did they do to deserve this? And then, what did they do to survive this? Their wounds, in reality quite minor, stayed with him. It was a formal evil of the act, perhaps. He didn't know. 30 people had been massacred that morning. Night had its own activity. He woke and was attached instantly to the sounds of the world. A dogfight, a man running to fetch something, the pouring of water into a vessel. When Gamini was a boy, nights were terrifying to him. His eyes wide open till he fell asleep, certain that he and his bed had lost their moorings in the darkness. He needed loud clocks beside him. Ideally, he would have a dog in the room, or someone, an aunt, or an ayah who snored. Now, working or sleeping during the night shifts, he was secure with all of the human and animal activity beyond the ward's light. Only bird life, so vocal and territorial during the day, was shut down, though there was one Polonara rooster that cried out false dawns from 3 a.m. Interns had been trying to kill it. He walked the stretch of hospital from wing to wing, open air on either side of him. There was a buzz of electricity close beside the pools of light as you passed them. You were aware of it only at night. You saw a bush and you sensed it growing. Someone came out and poured blood into a gutter and coughed. Everyone had a bad cough in Polonara. He was aware of every sound, a shoe or sandal step, the noise of a bed spring when he lifted a patient, the snapping of an ampule. Sleeping in the wards, he could be one limb of a large creature, linked to the others by the thread of noises. Later, if he was unable to sleep in the district medical officer's building, he would walk back the 200 yards along the empty, curfewed main street to the hospital. The nurse, stationed at a night desk, would turn and see the look on him and find a bed for him, and he would be asleep in seconds. In the cafeteria of the base hospital, a half-hour break in his shift, a woman sat down at Garmini's table and drank her tea, ate a biscuit with him. It was about 4 a.m, and he didn't know her. He just nodded to her. He felt private and too tired to talk. "I helped you with an operation once, some months ago, the massacre night." His mind wheeled back a century. "I thought you got transferred." "Yes, I was, and I came back here." He hadn't recognized her at all. She had a mask on when he spent the long, crucial hours with her over the boy. And when she was not wearing a mask in pre-op, he had probably only glanced at her. Their comradeship had been mostly anonymous. "You're married to someone here, right?" She nodded. There was a scar at her wrist. It was new. He would have noticed that during the surgery. He looked up quickly at her face. "It is very good to meet you." "Yes, for me too," she said. "Where did you go?" He got stationed at Kurunagala. Garmini kept watching her, the way she was selecting the words carefully. Her face was young and lean and dark, her eyes bright, as if it were daylight. "Actually, I've passed you in the wards a lot." "I'm sorry." "No, I know you didn't recognize me. Why should you?" A pause. She put her hand through her hair and then was very still. "I've seen that boy." "That boy?" She looked down, smiling to herself now. "The boy we operated on. I visited him. They renamed the boy Garmini, the parents, after you. It was a lot of trouble, red tape for them to do that." "Good, so I have an heir." "Yes, you do." "I'm training now, extra hours in the children's ward." She was about to continue, then stopped. He nodded, suddenly tired. What he wanted in his life now seemed a huge thing. What he wished for would involve the lives of others, years of effort, chaos, unfairness, lying. She looked at her tea and drank the last of it. "It was good to meet you." "Yes." Garmini rarely saw himself from the point of view of a stranger. Though most people knew who he was, he felt he was invisible to those around him. The woman, therefore, stood alongside him and clattered about in the almost empty house of his heart. She became, as she had done that night of the operation, the sole accompanist to what he thought, what he worked on. When later he turned over the hands of a patient, he thought of the scar at her wrist, the way her fingers had slipped through her hair, what he wished to reveal to her. But it was his own heart that could not step into the world. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them, and I'll be evasive as usual. Yes? Was the process for writing this book different than from other books? No, pretty much the same. You know, you sort of begin with absolutely nothing, and then you end up about 7 years later with something. You know, I mean, it's a pretty exhausting process, really. You know, I really would like to write a Noel Coward comedy one day. You know, and I just don't think I've got it in me. But I just began the book with the idea of someone coming back to a country that they had been a part of and was now a stranger to, and what happens as she gets re-educated in one way by the people she meets, and also what she brings to that place. But I mean, that was a very general, and I can look back on the book now and say that's what the book was about, but I didn't know what the book was about when I was actually writing it, you know. I was sort of discovering it. Yes? Right. The question was, do I continue to write poetry? Well, the book that came out a couple of years ago was a book of poems called Handwriting, and that was what I worked on when I finished The English Patient. And so that was, it was very important for me to work on that book and to write those poems. And that slid into this book in some way. And for some of the time, they were going hand in hand. So, yes, definitely. I don't know what the influence is, if there is an actual influence. It's not a, poetry isn't a process towards, you know, a step towards fiction at all. It's a very different thing, but certainly the influences are there, and both ways, going both ways. I think there's a poem called The Brother Thief in that collection, which is almost like a little story, you know, so then there are kind of stories within the poems and poems within the larger story. Yes? The question was, how do I do my research? Is it integrated into the writing or is it separate? It happens simultaneously usually, the research. I mean, I know some people do research on, you know, hairstyles in 1936 and then, you know, meditate on that and then they write a sequence about that. I haven't done that myself, but I tend to try and do the research at the same time as I'm writing. So it's as a kind of excitement of discovering something and simultaneously making something out of it. You know, I remember when I was working on In the Skin of a Lion, there was the building of the bridge was being, I was sort of researching that while I was writing the sequence of the bridge building. And that kind of gave it a bit more life than perhaps, you know, just using it as material for a fictional moment. So the research happens quite randomly, but and not very formally, you know, and then you have kind of use the research very lightly if you can, you know, not in clumps. So it's all those things are involved. Yeah. How long did this book take as compared to the other ones? It took me about, well, I began it about 93, and I finished it recently, you know. So that's about 7 years. My books usually take about 5 or 6 years, so there's a lost year in there somewhere, I think. Yes? The book is very scathing about governments in Sri Lanka. First of all, it's not scathing just about governments in Sri Lanka. I want to make that clear. You know, it's not everyone. I mean, there are no kind of ideal political parties as far as I can see. Secondly, the government that's there now is not the same government that there was in this period in the 80s, you know. And also, you know, this is a fiction. It is a kind of, you know, it is a political situation that the book is, political time the book is set, but it is very much a fiction. So all of those things are slightly modify what you're getting at, I guess. But the book has been out there now, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks. I don't really know the response. But it is a very, thing is, you know, political parties change very fast. And some parties which were kind of illegal now become legal and, you know, so forth. And so it feels a very different, it's a country still at war, but it's a different kind of set of characters almost. Yes? Do I make false starts and then do I reclaim them? Yeah, for most about the first three or four years, they're all false starts, you know. And then I had to decide which false start to keep. During that first process of actually writing the story, it is a kind of discovery of the story. So then when I go back to edit the book, it is very much a case of shifting things around, trying to see how I can make sense of the story that's in there somewhere, somewhat submerged or, you know, covered up with too many plots or characters or, you know, bits of random writing. And so, I mean, in fact, the prologue, for instance, that's in starts of the book now, was something that was in the middle of the novel and didn't really make much sense to me there. And I dropped it. And then later on, long after I had the kind of book, you know, as it was, I thought, well, that might work at the beginning, and that does something. That kind of sets up Anil's track record almost. You know, sets up that she's done this kind of thing before, and it shows some humanity in her because she's pretty feisty at first. So for lots of reasons, you kind of move things for something like that, you know. Yeah, back there. Writing about things that scare me or that I'm fearful of, not because I want to, but because I have to. I don't know much more what else to say about that. I mean, that's pretty revealing already, you know. I guess I'm writing about stuff not sure I can deal with, you know, in that sense. So, I mean, to take on a subject like this, or that's also quite personal, obviously, is very scary. I mean, the act of writing a book of this kind is very scary, or any kind of book, quite honestly. But I suppose you're sort of debating and asking and meditating on subjects that are very essential to you. They may be terrifying to you, but they're very essential and very much part of our world. So in that sense, I do that, yeah. Yes? Do I see a connection between the trip back I made for Running in the Family and Anil's trip? No, actually. I suppose I was very consciously not, when I would go back, not try and deal with family. I dealt with family personally, but I tried to kind of meet other people who were not so much part of the normal family circle. And I think, in spite of the fact that Anil, like me, is someone who returns as a stranger and has had a Western education, I don't see myself in any way reflected in Anil, apart from the situation. I think something else is going on in that book. You know, it is an invention. Yes? This is quite a complicated question. It was about how language gets lost or where language is located in as a permanent thing in this book. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I need about a week. But in Sri Lanka there's a thing called the stone book, and it's a thing that Palipana and also Sarath talk about. It's this huge block of granite where they've carved out some early texts. And what is very beautiful about that, and as in other kind of places in Sri Lanka, is the writing on rock. And actually, I was going to read a last section about what Sarath feels about that rock, which I didn't because of time. And it's almost like that's all that's permanent, you know. And it's like that image of the forest monastery where, you know, people of the future where everyone has left, and that all that's, you have the birds and the fish and the water and insects and a twig full, you know, twigs on the path. So it's kind of trying to see images of history in different ways, I think, in the book. Maybe a couple more questions or no more questions? One more, yeah? No, I don't keep track of time in the story when I'm writing. You know, I have a rough sense in my head. You know, it's like remembering what the characters are like. So, I mean, I know that there's a 7-week period that Anil is in Sri Lanka for. And that's set up quite early on. So that's the kind of one set time sequence. But then, you know, against that is someone like Palipana, who's the old guy. And, I mean, he's talking about centuries of, you know, culture and centuries of violence and history and, you know, art. So there's got this very odd, you know, 7 weeks to, you know, like 15 centuries happening there. At some point in any book, if you have a good editor, you have this the miraculous magic of the copy editor who kind of goes through all those things and says, well, Anil was 12 when this happened, but later on you say she's 7. And I mean, this incredible detail kind of x-ray of every mistake you've made in the book. And actually, most people hate these people. They feel like it's like a raw thing. But I kind of love it. You know, it's sort of very interesting where you realize that your whole book has just fallen apart, you know. Anyway, thank you very much.
That was Michael Ondaatje speaking in Portland in 2001. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Join A to Z Wineworks and help make this podcast and all our programming possible. Give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts Board, staff, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.